if you think about all the jobs that you've had in your life, what the best jobs and the worst jobs? What made the best jobs that you had the best jobs? What made the worst jobs you had? What made them so bad?
Coworkers.
Coworkers. Yeah, right? I mean, even if the job's kind of lame, if you've got people that are fun to work with, that's usually pretty good. If you've got your dream job, but everyone there is a jerk and miserable, not as fun, right? So a lot of times we go through life, and we're trying to understand who God is, and we finally get to the point where we ask the question, what does God want me to do? What does God want us to do? By the way, we think in our kind of individualistic society of what does God want me to do, but a lot of times we should be thinking, what does God want us collectively to do? Because we are people, we're connected to each other. And what God is looking for throughout Scripture is he's looking for a partner. He's looking for coworkers. He's looking for good coworkers. The Bible is the story of a God who wants to partner with us to co-create beauty and goodness. It all started in a garden. And he put Adam and Eve in the garden, and he gave them dominion over the earth and said, take care of this garden. But he didn't just, like, here's a garden, see you in 1,000 years, right? He walked with them in the cool of the day. There was a partnership there. He made this thing, and then he handed it off, but he didn't abandon them. He didn't abandon his creation. I wonder what they must have discussed in the afternoons that he came and visited them in the garden. Hey, do you think that plant would look good over here? What if we planted some of this over here? Do you think that would grow good there? Yeah, I think that'd be great. I just wonder. Co-creating with God. You know, when Marissa and I got married, she moved into my house that I'd had for a couple of years. And she says, is it okay if I put some stuff up on the walls? I said, of course it is. We share this space. I want to co-create this with you. In fact, I've left space where, you know, I'm not an interior decorator. I'm not going to fill the walls with stuff. Now, there's some stuff I want, you know, a couple things I want. And then there's, what do you want? Oh, that's an interesting, I don't know why you have so many pictures of clowns. And no, I'm kidding. I'm kidding. She has a very good sense of taste. And so we co-create together because we have a relationship and we want to work together. But working together, if you've ever had a job, is hard because, well, let's face it, we make a lot of mistakes. And we have some messed up ideas about what good looks like. I mean, I guess some people do think clowns look good. I don't know, on the wall. Some people got a really weird sense of style. And in fact, when it comes to working with God, we've rebelled against God. We've said, no, I have a better idea of what good is than you do, and I want to do things my way, which is why we need a mediator. And so last week we talked about how Jesus is a priest, and a priest is a person who represents us to God and God to us. He mediates between us and God. And so Jesus is the priest king that was prophesied in Psalm 110, which points back to the mysterious priest king Melchizedek all the way back in Genesis 11, and he blessed Abraham. And so we look at what Hebrews says, kind of continuing on from last week. Now, he says, the main point of what we're saying is this. We have such a high priest, one who sat down at the right hand, the throne of the majesty in heaven, a minister in the sanctuary, the true tabernacle that the Lord, not man, set up. For every high priest is appointed to offer both gifts and sacrifices. So this one, too, had to have something to offer. Now, if he were on earth, if Jesus were on earth, he would not be a priest. There's already priests doing this, right, who offer the gifts prescribed by the law. They're just down the road in Jerusalem. They're working in the temple. They're doing this. The place where they serve, though, is a sketch and a shadow of the heavenly structure. That just as Moses was warned by God as he was about to complete the tabernacle, for he says, see that you made everything according to the design, shown to you in the mountain. Here's where it gets important. But now Jesus has obtained a superior ministry, since the covenant that he mediates is also better and is enacted on better promises. So a priest is someone who fulfills the terms of a covenant by making sacrifices in the temple. That's what Hebrews is talking about here. He's saying that Jesus is a better priest because he's a better covenant with with a better sacrifice and a better temple. And we say, cool, yay for better covenants, I guess. Now, I don't know about you. I don't think about covenants in my everyday life. When was the last time you said, let me make a covenant with you? Well, some of you got married, and that's what you were doing, even if you didn't know it. There's different kinds of covenants. Some of you bought a house with an HOA, and you signed a covenant. That's kind of like that. It's kind of like a contract. Covenant's almost more like a treaty, though, the way it was in the Eastern world, the ancient Middle East. It's actually a fairly common thing for people to enter into and for particularly nations to enter into. And there's a couple of different kinds of covenants, but a promissory covenant, which is the main thing we're going to focus on, it focuses on the relationship between two people who have a power differential. Sometimes you hear this called a suzerain and a vassal. The suzerain is this powerful king. He controls a lot, got a big army maybe, he's got a lot of wealth. He's the big guy. And then you have the vassal who is, well, they're poorer. And, you know, maybe these relationships can be a little bit different. Sometimes, some cases, it's sort of like having a mob boss and people are paying him for the protection racket. But sometimes a powerful king would take someone who had shown extraordinary loyalty to him and he would grant him something. He would give him a royal grant. He'd gift him something. He'd say, I want to give this to you. Now, you owe some things to me, but I'm going to do some really cool things for you because I can. I like you. And so there's a lot we could go into when it comes to covenants. I'm not going to do a comprehensive thing, but I want to pull out a few things that are pretty common, a couple of features that are common in most of the covenants we're going to be looking at. Covenants include obligations for each party. The powerful person says, I'm going to do some things for you. And the other party says, I'm going to do things for you. So it might be, I will protect you if someone invades, and you have to pay me tribute, for instance, right? Typically, there'd be blessings involved in a covenant. If you abide by the terms of covenants, the gods will bless you, right? Likewise, there'll be curses. If you don't, if you break the covenant, you're going to be cursed. And so it's a very serious thing. And then what they would do for the curses, incidentally, is just so that people would know that this was a serious thing, that you shouldn't take this lightly, there's usually some sort of animal sacrifice. There's usually some sort of blood. And the implication is, see what we're doing to this animal? If you don't, you don't know. It's kind of gruesome. And then finally, a covenant would generally have a sign. It would have something to guarantee it, something to remind the suzerain. What would generally happen is the vassal would have some symbol of this, right, some sign of this, and they'd hold on to it tight because, you know, if they needed that protection, they'd go to the big king, the big dog, and say, hey, you remember, you promised to do some things. And he'd be like, who are you? And they'd be like, remember, you gave me this. And so really appreciate it if you'd come through on that. And so that's kind of how it worked. Now, God uses covenants in the Bible to form partnerships with people. He kind of takes this structure that was floating around and he says, sure, I'll work with that. And here's the thing about looking at the Old Testament. Sometimes people get the idea that God was pretty antagonistic towards us. He's like really hard on us throughout the Old Testament. He was that big, tough, mean king that, you know, super powerful and it's kind of a jerk, right? And maybe he finally decided to give us a break, you know, with the New Testament. But I want to take a look at some of the covenants God makes to see if that's actually the case. Because if we understand what it means to have a covenant with God, then we'll have a better understanding of the invitation that God has for us in this new covenant that Jesus has mediated for. And let me tell you, that new covenant can change our lives. So Join me on a little Bible study. We're going to start all the way back in Genesis 8 with Noah. Now, this is where the interactive part. We know some things about Noah, right? What was he famous for? He built a boat. Yeah, a big ark. And why did he build an ark? Yeah, God told him, you should maybe build yourself a boat because it's going to get wet around here. And so the thing is that God looks around at everything and says, everyone's just being terrible. The earth is filled with violence. And let me tell you, God does not like it when his kids kill each other. But then he sees Noah and says, this one guy, maybe he'll be a partner with it. He seems like he's interested in following me. He looks like he's interested in doing what's right and taking care of people. I wonder if he'll be a partner. And so we kind of heard the story. There's a flood. You know, what's interesting is that it's similar to a lot of other flood stories that float around from that time. You might have heard the Epic of Gilgamesh. So some really strikingly similar elements, but what's very different is how the biblical flood story ends. The Epic of Gilgamesh, the gods sort of let things get out of hand, and then Gilgamesh has to come and beat him up. Gilgamesh is just some king that, I guess, wanted to feel important, so he had a story written about him. But the biblical flood story ends very, very differently. I'm just going to pick up in Genesis 8:20, and I'm going to read a few verses, and then we're going to try to see how this fits into this covenant. So, Genesis 8:20, Noah built an altar to the Lord. He then took some of every kind of clean animal and clean bird and offered burnt offerings on the altar. And the Lord smelled the soothing aroma and said to himself, I'll never again curse the ground because of humankind, even though the inclination of their minds is evil from childhood on. I will never again destroy everything that lives. Skipping down to chapter 9, then God blessed Noah and his sons and said to them, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. And then he gives them things to eat. Skipping down to verse 4, you must not eat meat with its life, that is its blood in it. For your lifeblood, I will surely exact punishment from every living creature. I'll exact punishment from each person. I will exact punishment for the life of the individual, since the man was his relative. Whoever sheds human blood by their humans, by his blood must be shed. For in God's image, God has made humankind. Don't kill each other. How many times do I have to say it? And then finally, a little bit lower in verse 12, God said, this is the guarantee of the covenant I'm making with you and every living creature with you, a covenant for all subsequent generations. I will place my rainbow in the clouds, and it will become a guarantee of the covenant between me and the earth. Whenever I bring clouds of the earth and the rainbow appears in the clouds, then I will remember my covenant with you and all the living creatures of all kinds. Okay, so that's how this ends, as God says, I'm going to make a covenant with you. Now, let's see if do we remember what a covenant has? A covenant has obligations. What are the obligations that God is taking? This is the interactive part. By the way, if you're online, I have this little chat window. You can even chat online. I can see it. Isn't that cool? Technology is great. I just want you to feel included if you're joining us online. What are the obligations that God is taking under this covenant? Bueller? Won't destroy the whole earth. How about what obligations is Noah taking? This one's kind of a trick question.
He did the right thing.
Yeah, you know what's funny is God doesn't really ask much of Noah in this particular covenant. Now, Noah is kind of implicitly supposed to be the first human again, right? Because got rid of everybody else. So he's sort of the forefather of everything again. He's kind of the next Adam. Let's try this again. Try to do a little better. And by the way, please don't kill anyone. Enough killing of each other. Okay, so what's the sacrifice that's involved? Usually a covenant has some sort of blood sacrifice in it. Anyone remember? A few verses back, this is where having your Bible open is handy. Well, Noah sacrificed birds, right? Were there any blessings in this covenant?
The birds came back.
What are the blessings in the covenant? Be fruitful and multiply. Yeah, absolutely. Chapter 9 starts with God blessed Noah and his sons. Be fruitful and multiply. And finally, this is where this gets fun. Does this covenant come with a guarantee? A rainbow, yeah. And this is cool, right? Because what God says, remember we talked about how a covenant, you have something, and you take it to the big king, and you say, remember? And so what is God saying here? This is the guarantee of the covenant. I place my rainbow, and whenever I see it, I will remember, right? You seeing how this works? God will see it and remember. And what's fun is that usually he gives a sign of the covenant to the people he's making a covenant with. You come and remind me if I forget. But he doesn't give Noah the sign to hold on to. So I'm going to put it up in the clouds where you're not going to lose it, right? You're not going to misplace it. Even if you forget this covenant, I'm going to remember because I'm going to see it. One other fun thing about rainbow. In the Hebrew, there's no real word for rainbow. It just says bow. Like, you know, like a bow like you shoot, right? And I want you to think about a rainbow. Visualize it in your mind. Beautiful Colorado day. Rains come across the plains. You see this rainbow. Which direction is... If you put an arrow in that bow, which way would it be pointed? Straight up. In other words, God takes his warrior bow and he hangs it up. He says, this is not a threat. This is not, I'm pointing it at you. You know, has anyone taken a gun safety class? What do they tell you to never do?
No point down.
No point. What do you never point a gun at? You never point at anything you don't intend to kill, right? So where does God point his arrow? He doesn't point it at us. Points it at himself. He's saying, I'm going to remember, and it's on me, right? So this is a covenant with Noah. Pretty cool. All right. So this is great. You know, God's found a partner. We're going to start. We're going to do it right this time. How does that go? Well, if you keep on reading, and I'm going to skip that part because it's ugly. Things go badly. Noah messes up. It's more of the same. Oh, goodness. So, fast forward a few hundred years. There's this guy named Abram, and he's living in Ur, the Chaldeans, and God says, we could go into, why does God see Abraham? Why does God notice Abraham? It's a very interesting question. Rabbis have debated it for millennia. But God notices something about him, says, hey, I want to see something. Do you want to come on a trip with me? Do you want to just leave everything and start something new? And Abraham goes, okay. All right. And so he moves way far away. God makes him this promise in Genesis 15. After these things, the word of the Lord came to Abram in a vision. Fear not, Abram, I'm your shield, and I'm the one who will regard you with great abundance. And Abram's like, okay, what does that mean? And by the way, I don't have any heirs, so you're going to bless me with a bunch of stuff, and then what? And so the word of the Lord came to him, this man will not be your heir. Instead, a son comes from your own body will be your heir. And God takes him outside and says, look at the sky and count the stars if you're able to count them. So will your descendants be. And Abram believed the Lord, and the Lord considered his response of faith as proof of genuine loyalty. He counted it to him as righteousness, is what Hebrews says. So make a note of that. That's going to come up in Hebrews later on in this series. So let's see if we can spot what are the obligations of this covenant that God says he's going to make. And kind of this is split up between two different times, chapter 15, chapter 17. Looking at chapter 17 real quick. When Abraham was 99 years old, I don't know how many 99-year-olds you know that are having kids. The Lord appeared to him and said, I am the sovereign God. Walk before me and be blameless. Then I will confirm my covenant between me and you, and I will give you a multitude of descendants. So what is God's obligation? What's God's obligation? That's Abraham's obligation. Abraham's obligation, walk in my presence. Walk and be blameless. Follow my lead, right? Okay. What's God's obligation? Make him a great nation. And in fact, if you look at what God said a few chapters before when he first started this conversation with Abraham, he said, I'm going to make you a great nation, and that nation will bless the whole world. And so that's what God's up to. That's what he's going to do. Does this have a sacrifice? Well, this is where it gets weird. You down for a little weird? The Lord said to him, I am the Lord who brought you out from Ur of the Chaldeans to give you this land to possess. But Abraham said to his sovereign Lord, by what can I know that I am possess it? I feel like I need something. You're going to make a covenant? You're going to give me something? The Lord said to him, take for me a heifer, goat, and a ram, and each 3 years old, along with a dove and a young pigeon. So Abram took all these for him and cut them into two and placed each half opposite the other, but he didn't cut the birds in half. The birds of prey came down the carcass, and Abram drove them away. When the sun went down, Abram fell sound asleep, and a great terror overwhelmed him. Now, that's pretty gruesome. He takes some animals, cuts them in half, puts them side here and side there, and what is happening seems pretty weird. Well, they had a tradition around covenants at the time. If you made a covenant with someone, very serious thing, there's got to be some animal sacrifices. And in fact, they take these animals. And some people think that when God told them those specific animals, he goes, we're making a covenant. I know what to do. Cut them in half, put them on the ground. And the blood comes down. And what you're supposed to do is each person who's making the covenant walks through the blood. And there's kind of the implication there, right? If I don't do what I say I'm going to do, that's what I'm going to look like afterwards, right? It's gruesome. I'm sorry. But then if you've got a suzerain, you've got a vassal, you've got a big, powerful person, you've got a weak person, who do you think walks that blood path first? Who does it first?
The weak person.
The weak person. And so who's the weak person, God or Abram? Abram, right? Okay. And so Abram, what does he do? He falls asleep and is terrified. Okay. I mean, he obviously knows how this works. He obviously knows what to do. And then he's like, oh, what have I gotten myself into? But we keep reading. When the sun had gone down and it was dark, a smoking fire pot with a flaming torch passed between the animal parts. And that day, the Lord made a covenant with Abraham. All right, so the torch, smoking pot, torch. Where have we seen smoke and fire? Does that ring any bells? It's the presence, right? When the Israelites are following God through the wilderness, there's a pillar of smoke. In the night, there's a column of fire. And the smoke and fire come around in many prophetic visions. They're often a symbol of God's presence. Why does God need two signs of his presence? Why does God need two signs of his presence to walk this blood path? He's got to do it twice, right? Once for Abram, and once for himself. Abram says, I don't know that I'm down for this covenant. And God says, okay. This whole implied curse here, I'm going to take that. If you don't hold up your end, that's on me too. Wow. Okay. So Abram never walks the blood path, and yet the Bible says God made a covenant with him. Does this covenant have any blessings? Well, yes, it does. Genesis 17, verse 7. I'll confirm my covenant as a perpetual covenant between me and you. I'll extend your descendants. I'll be your God. I'll give you the whole land of Canaan, the land where you're now residing. So it's got some blessings. Does it come with a sign of the guarantee? Verse 10. This is my requirement that you and your descendants must keep it. Every male among you must be circumcised. You must circumcise the flesh of your foreskins. This will be a reminder of the covenant between you and me. Oh, so we do have a reminder. Oh, and by the way, the sign of the covenant, you're not going to misplace this, I promise. Incidentally, someone also points out that this is kind of a weird thing. He said, every male, not just you, everyone. We're not going to have some people being better than others here. Some people are special. No, it's every male, even down to the servants. We're all equal here. Okay. So, covenant with Abraham, let's recap. Did we have obligations? Yeah? Okay. Did we have a curse or a sacrifice? Oh, yeah. We had that whole blood path thing. Do we have a blessing? God's going to give them the land of Canaan. Do we have a sign or a guarantee? We did. Okay. This is working out. So, obviously, he makes a covenant with Abram. Everything is great, right? Abraham is like the most awesome guy ever, right? And the end. Right? No? Some of you are laughing. It makes me think that maybe if we kept on reading, we'd find that Abraham, he did some pretty cool stuff, and then he did some, oh gosh, it gets awkward. All right, so we looked at a couple of different covenants. God's looking for a partner. Things aren't quite working out, but the descendants of Abraham do, in fact, multiply. God kept his end, but they're slaves in Egypt. And so God rescues them and says, all right, I took you out of Egypt, and I'm looking for a partner. I'm looking for a people to partner with. So this is when we flip over to Exodus 19. And he says, you yourselves have seen what I did to Egypt and how I lifted you on eagle's wings and brought you to myself. And now if you will diligently listen to me and keep my covenant, then you will be my special possession out of all nations. The whole earth is mine, but you will be to me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. A kingdom of priests. Now, we'll recap from last week, if you were here last week. What's a priest do again? Mediator. Mediator. What's another word for mediator? What else does a priest do? It's similar to being a mediator. The other word I used. Representative, right? Okay, so Israel's supposed to be a mediator, but they're also supposed to represent God to the nations. This is what it looks like when you have God living among you. This is how good God is. Do you want to know God? Come visit us. See how we live, because we're going to show you what God lives. That's God's wanting us to partner, to show his goodness amongst the people. So, does this covenant have obligations? Well, yeah. I mean, the Lord promises to give them this promised land, right, of rest. We talked about rest a few weeks ago. He's going to give them a land of rest, of abundance. He's going to elevate them above all people. And what are the people's obligations? Well, he's going to give them a bunch of commandments. If you keep reading, you get a whole list of them. There's 10 commandments, and then there's a whole bunch more, and then there's a whole bunch more. And also, by the way, we're going to have like a tabernacle, and you're going to perform sacrifices in it, and we're going to have this whole ritual thing set up. So there's a lot more involved in this one. In fact, this is one of the more formal covenants. Some people have really pointed out there's a lot of striking similarities between this and other covenants that are inscribed on clay tablets between different nations structurally. So it's kind of interesting. But we're going to keep moving here because we got to get to the good stuff. Is there a sacrifice? Yeah. God makes this covenant with them. Then Exodus 24, sent Israelite men and they offered burnt offerings and sacrificed young bulls for peace offerings. And Moses took half the blood and put it in bowls and half the blood he splashed on the altar. And he took the book of the covenant, read it out loud to the people and said, and they said, we are willing to do and obey all that the Lord has spoken. And so Moses took the blood and splashed it on the people and said, this is the blood of the covenant that the Lord has made with you in accordance to all these words. Wow. Covenants are bloody things. Incidentally, if you go to the end of Deuteronomy, 40 years later, they're going to reaffirm this covenant. And they're going to have Israelites on one mountain and Israelites on the other mountain, and they're going to be shouting back and forth to each other, and these are going to be shouting the curses that will happen if they don't follow, and these are going to be shouting the blessings, and so you can read all about those in Deuteronomy 27, 28, 29. But there's a whole list of those, and so I'm just going to skip down. Is there a sign of this covenant? Well, if you continue on in Exodus, the next thing after he sprinkles them with blood is God's like, okay, you're going to build a tabernacle, and in this tabernacle you're going to have What goes in the tabernacle? Tablets. And where do the tablets go in? They go in a box. They go in an ark. Okay. Yeah, okay. So if you've seen, Indiana Jones, you know all about the Ark of the Covenant, right? It's basically just like that. But here's what actually Hebrews talks about this. We're in Hebrews. Let's read from Hebrews 9. The tabernacle contained the golden altar of incense and the Ark of the Covenant covered entirely with gold. And in this ark were the golden urn containing the manna, Aaron's rod that budded, and the stone tablets of the covenant. And above the ark were the cherubim of glory overshadowing the mercy seat. Now is not the time to speak of these things in detail, so we won't. We've got to keep moving. But these are the items that represented these powerful moments where God has shown up. And so God's saying, okay, you're gonna hang on to the sign of the covenant this time. These things that represent these places where I've come through to you, I want you to keep them really safe. You're going to put the law that I'm giving you, the covenant there, I'm going to put it together. It's going to go before the people. All right. We got a covenant with the people of Israel. We've got obligations. We've got sacrifice. We've got blessings. We've got a sign. It's a covenant, right? Okay, we see how this works. Now, before we go on to the really cool part, real quick recap. What's God's ask every time he makes a covenant? What does he want? If you're online, you can chat too. What's that?
Partner.
Yeah, he wants a partner. He wants someone who will work with him to bring goodness to the world, to co-create, to love people. And so if you think about all the things that God committed to doing and all the things he asked the other party to commit to doing, do you know something kind of funny? Does it seem like God was maybe offering to do a whole lot more than he was getting back in return? Every time?
Yeah.
Like a lot more. Like try not to kill people. walk in my presence. He asked the people of Israel to do a bunch more, but a lot of that was because, okay, clearly we need to explain this in some detail because you don't understand how to do this. But we got a problem because Israel didn't meet the terms of the covenant either. How is God going to find a partner when everybody fails to hold up their end? Well, you remember who the bow was pointed at? Remember who walked the blood path? Is this an antagonistic, harsh God? Or has he been telling the same story the whole time? Is this the same God that sent his son, Jesus? Well, the Old Testament has many covenants in it, but it ends with some prophets. And the prophets have these visions, and God speaks to them. They write it down, and Jeremiah is one of these people who has a vision who, this is a beautiful, beautiful passage from Jeremiah 31. Indeed, a time is coming, says the Lord, when I will make a new covenant with the people of Israel and Judah. It will not be like the old covenant that I made with their ancestors when I delivered them from Egypt. For they violated that covenant, even though I was like a faithful husband to them. See, this covenant he makes with Israel has a lot of similarities to marriage covenants. He's like, I helped my end. I did my part. But I will make a new covenant with the whole nation of Israel after I plant them back in the land. I will put my law within them and write it on their hearts and minds. I will be their God, and they will be my people. And people will no longer need to teach their neighbors and relatives to know me, for all of them, from the least important to the most important, will know me. For I will forgive their sin and will no longer call to mind the wrong they have done. There's going to be a new covenant. So Hebrews quotes this exact passage, the whole thing, and says, you know that thing God promised he was going to do? Well, he did. And then it continues to say, when he speaks of a new covenant, he makes the first obsolete. Now, what's growing obsolete and aging is about to disappear. And what's interesting is he writes this maybe a couple of years before the temple is destroyed, and all these different things they were doing to meet the terms of the covenant were literally about to disappear. And so here's what's cool about this new covenant is Jesus is the one who fulfills the obligations. In fact, he fulfills the obligations of all of those covenants. He's the one who has the favor of Yahweh, like Noah. He's the first of a new kind of human. He's the one who walked the blood path and walked in the presence of God. He did what he saw the Father was doing. Jesus is the one who perfectly fulfills the law. He's the perfect priest. He provides the perfect sacrifice. And then Jesus comes and tells you, and he tells me, come follow me if you're weary, because my yoke is easy and my burden is light. So he's the co-worker that shows us how it's done. You ever have a co-worker and you're like, I don't know what I'm doing? And someone's like, hey, let me show you. Do you like this, right? Oh, it's the co-worker that helps clean up after we've made a mess. Do you ever work somewhere and you just, oh gosh, you made a real mess of things, and someone came and was like, oh man, let me help you with that. We'll take care of this. He's the coworker that remembered to put away the milk when we left and forgot it, right? It's got our back. And so we can either hide in the corner, right? We can try to hide out at work and maybe no one will see us and maybe we'll get by. Or we can pay attention. We can learn from his example, his guidance. We can welcome the gift of his Holy Spirit to write his law in our hearts. So what does that look practically? How do we get God's law written on our hearts? How do we learn from him as a coworker? I think the first thing that's the most important thing to remember is it's not about measuring up to a standard. It's not about trying harder. We tried that. It's not about, well, here's the rules, and if you could just get better at following the rules, if you could just be better, you know? That's not what Jesus is going to do as a coworker. Instead, he's going to help us to grow. And the thing about growing means you have to do things that make you uncomfortable. Yeah, that's right, Ronnie. You got it. Growing requires us to do things that might fail. We have to take risks. We have to try things. We have to make mistakes. Trusting that we have a coworker who can clean up after our mistakes if we do. Growing means that, well, we have to start by realizing that we don't know everything. Have you ever had a coworker? So for a while we had a software business with a dozen or so employees, a lot of junior coders, and some of them went on to become very successful and others didn't. And you know what the biggest thing was that made the difference between the ones who were successful and the ones who weren't? The ones who became successful, they were willing to ask for help. They were willing to say, I don't know that. In fact, the really successful ones would go and say, well, I think I figured out a way to do this. Is there a better way? Those are the really special ones, because I'd be like, great job figuring it out. Now let me show you what you really should do to avoid these other problems that you don't even know about yet. And because they came with that humility, okay, I'm not dumb, I can do things, but maybe there's something I don't know. Maybe I'm missing something, and they would come, and I would share my experience. And they would learn so much faster than the people who are like, no, I'm going to do everything myself, right? We had employees who never took risks. They refused to try things because they might mess up. So they just didn't get anything done. We had coworkers that wouldn't give us good feedback because that'd be uncomfortable. And so we'd never find out what was going on and where they needed help and where they needed assistance. So if we're willing to go to Jesus in humility and let him start teaching us and listen to him, accept that gift of the Holy Spirit, then we'll grow and he'll write his laws on our hearts and we'll become more like him and we'll be the partner that he's always been looking for. And incidentally, Jesus is really the partner, and we're just co-workers with him. But he's taking the load, right? If you go to get a loan and it's more than you can afford, what do you have to do?
Borrow
some money. If you can't borrow, if they won't loan you enough money, though, they're like, you get a cosigner. Bingo. Yeah. And so what has Jesus done for us? Well, he's cosigned, right? You can say, well, you can depend on me, and I'm going to help you, and we're going to do this together. So is this new? What do we know about a covenant? Covenant has some things. Does this new covenant have some things? Does it have obligations? Well, yeah. What's God's obligation? He's going to restore all things. What's our obligation? Well, Jesus has done all the obligation. All we have to do is follow him. All we have to do is trust him to go in the direction that he's leading us. Does this covenant have blessings? Yeah. We talked about our better rest a couple of weeks ago and how we can experience that now. God wants to restore creation through us. He wants us to have an abundant life. Does this have a curse associated with it, a sacrifice? Well, you better believe it. Hebrews 9, verse 15. And so Jesus is the mediator of a new covenant so that those who are called may receive the eternal inheritance he has promised, the blessing, since he died to set them free from the violations committed under the first covenant. For where there is a will, the death of the one who made it must be proven, for the will takes effect only at death, since it carries no force while the one who has made it is alive. So even the first covenant was inaugurated with blood. For when Moses had spoken every command to the people according to the law, he took the blood of calves and goats with water and scarlet wool and hyssop and sprinkled both the book itself and all the people and said, "This is the blood of the covenant that God has commanded you to keep." Remember that? Sure does. But what's the point of this? Well, verse 13, if the blood of goats and bulls and the ashes of young cows sprinkled on those who are defiled consecrated them and provided ritual purity, how much more will the blood of Christ, who through the eternal Spirit offered himself without blemish to God, purify our consciences from the dead, works to worship the living God. The law says, cursed is everyone who hangs on a tree. Jesus was crucified on a tree. He became the curse for us. His blood was the blood of the covenant. Covenants are bloody things. But Jesus took care of that for us. And this isn't something the author of Hebrews is just sort of making up. This is something Jesus said. Because the night before he was crucified, he had a meal with the disciples. And he took a cup after he'd eaten and said, "This is the cup that is poured out for you." And he said, "It's the new covenant in my blood." This is Jesus' words. He says, my blood's about to become the blood of the new covenant, and this is for you. So we've got obligations, we've got blessings, we've got sacrifice. Do we have a sign? Well, what does Hebrews say? Hebrews 7:22, accordingly, Jesus has become the guarantee of a new covenant. All those other covenants have guarantees, don't they? This one does too, and it's Jesus. The guarantee of the new covenant is Jesus himself. So how do we remember the guarantee? Well, Jesus is up in heaven. I guess we're not going to lose him. But how do we remember? Well, Jesus, in that same discussion in the upper room where he takes the cup, he also takes bread and he breaks it and says, "This is my body, which is broken for you." He says to do this, what? In remembrance of me. See, Jesus is the sign of the covenant. And so now we don't have to go and say, "God, remember your covenant," because Jesus is right there. He's not going to forget. But we need to remember the covenant for ourselves. We need to remember what God's going to do. And so in a moment, we're going to do just that. We're going to take the bread and the juice as a sign of the new covenant with God. So Marissa's going to come and just play some quiet music as we conclude. And I just want to conclude by saying we've looked at all these different covenants that God makes. He's telling the same big story. He's looking for a partner, and Jesus has made a way for us to be that partner. So this covenant is not like the old one. It's better. It doesn't depend on us getting everything right. It doesn't depend on us doing enough. It doesn't depend on us trying enough. But it is an invitation to do what God has wanted to do with people throughout history, to partner with them to create beauty and bring goodness to the world. And it's an invitation that's generously extended to us from a God who rescues and saves. An aspect of covenants I didn't talk about earlier is typically in a formal covenant, there would be a whole section in the beginning that would recite all the wonderful things that the suzerain did as a reminder that, well, he's doing you a favor. You should maybe have some gratitude, right? And that's something we want to do when we take the bread and the cup. So we want to take a moment to remember the things that God's done for us. We want to take a moment to remember what God's rescued us from. We want to take a moment to remember the things that he's blessed us with, because even when it feels like we don't have enough and we're waiting and it's tight and it's stressful, if you just take a step back, there's so many blessings that we have. And so when we take the bread and the cup, we're asking God to remember his commitment to us. Commitment he honors because Jesus has fulfilled our obligations already. And then we're remembering Jesus for what he did for us. Remembering that we have a great high priest who gives us grace and help in time of need. Remembering that he's our king and he gently leads us and teaches us. And he helps us to grow so that we can participate in his great work to bless the world. And we do this in faith, expecting to experience God's presence and allowing him to transform us. Would you pray with me? Jesus, we thank you for your work on the cross. We thank you that you've done what we couldn't do, and now you've sent your Spirit to fill us. That your burden is easy. Your yoke is easy and your burden is light. We thank you that we get to participate with you in the joyful things and the fun things. And even when it's hard, we know that what you're doing is going to be worth it. And that you are leading us into a greater place, into a promised land of rest and abundance. A place where we can continue to co-create with you. We thank you for your presence. Help us to remember your sacrifice. Is to remember the blessings that you have in store for us. If you'd like to join me in a moment, we're going to partake the bread and the cup. It's a reminder of the covenant that Jesus has made, a reminder of the invitation that we have. And so, God's presence is here with us now. There's something special about remembering his body broken for us, his blood poured out for us. And so I'm going to invite you all to come up the center aisle, as we often do, and you can go out the side aisles so we don't bump into each other. And if you need something from God, if you need a touch, if you need healing, if you need more of his Spirit, if you need encouragement, I'm going to encourage you to not miss the opportunity. I'm just going to sing a couple of verses as we partake, and I'll be available to pray for you afterwards. I think God has things he wants to do if you need a touch from him.